This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Welcome to Pax Britannica. I'm your host, Dr. Samuel Hume. This episode is from my Patreon bonus feed, and it's the first episode in our history of the Mughal Empire. This wasn't the episode I planned to release today, but I haven't been able to record the main narrative, partly my fault, partly out of my control. If you enjoy this episode and want to know how the story carries on, go to patreon.com/PaxBritannica to find out more. Without further ado, let us begin. On the 22nd of September 1398, an army of Mongols passed through the mountains of the Hindu Kush and crossed the Indus River over a bridge of boats. Mongols had been a fairly common sight on this side of the Hindu Kush since 1221, when they chased the last Khwarezmian Shah there and crushed his army. The previous Shah, his father, had made perhaps the worst decision in history and antagonized the Mongol Empire, newly forged under its founder and most famous ruler, Genghis Khan. At the Battle of the Indus, Genghis Khan utterly destroyed the young Shah's army, but after he escaped and could not be found, the Mongol warlord went no further than the banks of the Indus, and withdrew back over the mountains. Mongol raiders would descend on northwest India many times over the next two centuries, but rarely stayed. In normal times, the Indian sultanates weathered the raids until the Mongols were either defeated in pitched battle or withdrew with their plunder. But these were not normal times. The Sultanate of Delhi, the paramount power in the northwest, was not united. It was currently in the middle of a civil war between the last rulers of the Tughlaq dynasty. But even had Delhi been undivided and prepared, it might not have helped. Because the Mongols that crossed the Indus in 1398 were not just any raiding party. They were led by a conqueror, second only to his distant relative, Genghis Khan, in military skill and capacity for cruelty. This conqueror has been called many things. Shuja-ud-Din Timur, Timur-i-Leng, the Scourge of God, Timur the Lame, or Tamerlane. The Mongol-Turkic warlord ruled most of modern Iran, and at about 60 years old, he had plenty of expansionist energy left. On his death, just 7 years later, the Timurid Empire would stretch from the Persian Gulf in the south to the Central Asian steppes in the north, from Aleppo in the west to... well, let's find out. After crossing the Indus, Timur massacred and sacked his way across northern India. One contemporary described how Timur had to keep moving, because the stench of death was too strong to linger anywhere. He didn't kill everyone, though, and by the time he reached the capital of Delhi, he had tens of thousands of slaves in tow. Timur reached the walls of Delhi in December. Delhi was an imperial city, a vast and wealthy metropolis which had, in better times, ruled over most of the Indian subcontinent. The city was currently held by Malu Khan, a noble who controlled one of the two puppet Tughlaq sultans, but was the real power behind the throne. On the 12th of December, as his siege lines were being established, Timur led a scouting party to recon the defences of his latest target. On this expedition, Malu Khan sallied forth from the gates and attacked Timur's group. The attack was easily beaten off and Timur was unwounded, but rumours reached the main camp. Timur was injured. Timur was captured. Timur was dead. The prisoners, tens of thousands of them, apparently celebrated with a bit too much spirit, because when Timur returned to camp, very much alive, He viewed the army-sized population of captives as an unacceptable risk. Timur had a very Timurid solution. He ordered his soldiers to execute every adult male slave. Within an hour, it was done. Our sources disagree, and like all medieval sources, they must be taken with a hefty pinch of salt. But according to the chronicles, between 50 and 100,000 people were murdered in that hour. With this grisly work done, Timur turned his attention to Delhi. His main concern was not the infantry or regular cavalry which the Sultan or his puppet master could bring to the field. Let them come. He was Timur. What concerned him was the elephant in the room. The literal elephants, the war elephants, with blades attached to their tusks, with wooden turrets strapped to their backs, bristling with archers and crossbowmen. Some of them had rudimentary but still explosive rockets. These terrified Timur's army, and unless they were prepared, Timur might face a rare defeat. Timur would be prepared. His men, or at least their remaining slaves, built ramparts and ditches and hammered stakes into the ground with three metal prongs on the end. His cavalry, the backbone of any self-respecting Mongol warlord, were armed with caltrops, metal clusters of four prongs which could be thrown behind the rider and land with at least one point facing up. Hundreds of camels and other cattle had bundles of dried grass tied to their backs, which would be set on fire and herded towards the enemy. All of these measures were designed to make the elephants panic, either taking them out of the fight or, ideally, letting them trample through the Sultan's own ranks. On the 17th of December, Malu Khan and his puppet Sultan, Mahmud Shah, sallied forth in force. Accounts report that they led a force of 10,000 cavalry, 40,000 infantry, and what is described as a phalanx of elephants. When they advanced on the dug-in Timurids, the Mongols' ingenious preparations worked. Details are scarce, but the elephants seem to have panicked and trampled through the Delhi army. Timur was easily able to mop up as the Sultanate's leadership, including the Sultan himself as well as Malu Khan, fled back within the city walls and then out the other side. Timur spent the night encamped at the reservoir outside the walls, and the following day he enjoyed a triumphal entry into the metropolis. The conqueror sat on a throne in the centre of the city, as the leading citizenry bowed and scraped and gave tribute to their new master. Even the elephants, some 120 captured after the battle, knelt before him in the parade, which delighted the scourge of God. Timur ordered his imams to enter the great mosque and read the khutbah in his name, a ceremonial declaration of sovereignty, which we will see many times in this series. Then, after the bowing and the offerings ended, Timur withdrew from the city, back to his tents by the oasis, and left his agents to handle the grubby business of tallying and collecting tribute. But what started as an orderly submission of the metropolis ended in a sack. Over 10 days, the soldiers of Timur's army took everything that wasn't nailed down, and much that was. When they left Delhi, the glittering metropolis was a burning ruin. Soldiers were laden down with jewellery and riches, and those Delhi citizens who hadn't been killed or managed to escape were enslaved, more than making up for the men that Timur had ordered murdered. Timur himself took his pick of prisoners, and with his characteristic taste for artists and craftsmen, he was especially interested in Delhi's famous stonemasons. These he had shipped off to distant Samarkand, his glorious capital city, where they joined the thousands of other artisans, painters, writers, architects, weavers, glassblowers, silver and goldsmiths, and every other skilled profession, which Timur had collected on his conquests. So many had been taken prisoner and brought to the Timurid capital that visitors noted that there wasn't enough space for all of them, many of them sleeping in the open or in nearby caves. Those captured elephants were also brought to Samarkand, painted in fabulous colours, and positioned at the entrance of Timur's gardens. Even in his capital, Timur abhorred staying under a solid roof, and always slept in his sumptuous tents. After receiving tribute from Delhi's neighbours, terrified that the Mongol warlord might visit their cities, Timur took a leisurely path back west, sacking and pillaging as he went. In March 1399, he crossed back over the Indus River. He had spent only 6 months in India, and he left behind him a trail of blood and death. Tens of thousands had been forced into slavery, many more had been slaughtered by Timurid swords or struck down by plague and famine, which followed in their wake like night follows day. Timur would never again campaign in India. His attention would now look west, where he'd batter the other growing Turkic power in this period, the Ottomans, destroying more than one army of theirs. But his family, the Timurid dynasty, would dominate the Iranian plateau for the next 2 centuries, even as the empire he built on a foundation of bones collapsed into infighting. One of those Timurid princelings would return to Delhi more than a century after his great-great-great-grandfather. But he would not merely raid and pillage. He would stay, and forge an empire to rival that of his gruesome ancestor. That is, after all, the source of the name Mughal, the Persian word for Mongol. This second Mongol empire would be very different to its predecessor. Following Sunni Islam rather than worshipping Tengri, more Turkic or Persian than Mongolian, and an empire of Indian cities and splendor than felt tense and open steppe.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Welcome to the History of the Mughal Empire, Episode 1, The Throneless Times. Welcome to this bonus episode of Pax Britannica. This is the first in a Patreon series. The history of the English and then British Empire in India is, for a century, mostly a history of European traders attempting to gain influence and trading rights from the Indian states they found there, and the most powerful and wealthy of these was the Mughal Empire. But I don't want to look at the Mughal Empire just from the perspective of the British Empire. We'll cover that in the main feed, and it will get plenty of attention, especially as the East India Company begins to rival their Mughal hosts. But the Mughals are fascinating in their own right. By the late 17th century, the Peacock Throne would rule over a population of more than 100 million people, and cover territory of more than 3 million miles. The Mughal Empire was the peer of both the Ottoman Empire and Safavid Persia, both contemporary Muslim gunpowder superpowers, and debatably outshone both of them in wealth and power. The Qing Dynasty of China was the only contemporary larger and more powerful, but with the geographic barriers of Indochina, the host of maritime states of Southeast Asia, and, you know, the Himalayan mountain range, their contact was fairly limited. The Mughal Empire was an economic, military, and cultural powerhouse, and I'm excited to dive into its history and bring you along with me. We'll start our history of the Mughals in February 1483, with the birth of the eldest son of Umar Sheikh Mirza II Timurid, the Emir of Ferghana. His son was named Zahir ud-Din Muhammad, but history will know him as Babur, so that's what we'll call him. Babur was the 5th generation descendant of Timur through his father's side, and a 15th generation descendant of Genghis Khan through his mother's. He would prioritize his descent from the closer Sunni Muslim Timur over the more distant Tengri Temujin, and more than one historian has noted the irony that the empire Babur will establish has gone down in history as the Mughal-Mongol Empire. Fergana, in the region of Transoxiana in modern-day Uzbekistan, was a fairly prosperous province of the waning Timurid world. Since Timur's death, the boundaries of the Timurid Empire had shrunk, especially with the death of perhaps the last great Timurid Padishah, Shahrukh, in 1447. Since then, internal divisions and outside aggression, especially from the Akkoyunlu Confederation, had reduced Timurid territory. But the descendants of Timur still ruled over most of modern Iran and Afghanistan, in a patchwork of emirates and petty sultanates. Babur's father died of natural causes when his son was only 11. That natural cause was gravity. A keen keeper of pigeons, the emir had been in his dovecote on the edge of the roof of Akshi Fort when it suddenly collapsed, sending him plummeting to his death. Now Emir Babur did not have long to mourn his father. He was suddenly thrust into the dangerous world of Timurid politics, and he was determined to be a player. Their common ancestor, the dynastic founder Timur, was the only thing shared by the various petty kings, emirs, and governors who ruled the reduced Timurid world. Ambitions and rivalries kept the Timurid princelings in a state of constant warfare for control of different territories. The wealthy cities were the greatest prizes: Herat, Bukhara, and Timur's capital of Samarkand. But we shouldn't overstate how sedentary the Timurid princes were. Even in these metropolises, wealthy from agriculture and the trade of the Silk Road, many Timurid princes lived as Timur had, in grand gardens connected to the cities, in fabulously adorned tents decorated with tapestries and carpets from across the Muslim world. This preference for semi-nomadic living was helpful in the cut and thrust of Timurid politics. A prince's wealth was rarely in land or palaces, but in carpets and tapestries, silk tents, goblets and plates of gold and silver, horses, camels, cattle, swords, bows, armour, paintings, movable goods that could be bundled up at short notice or given out with gracious generosity to ensure loyalty from followers and mercenaries who demanded results and rewards. Wealth and power was often fleeting. The balance of power among the Timurid princes was constantly in motion. So, what of Babur? His new emirate, Fergana, bordered the territory belonging to Samarkand, the old imperial capital, and still a glittering jewel of an oasis. Shortly after Babur's ascension, one ruler of Samarkand, and then another, died within 6 months. Civil war for control of the city and the territory soon followed, and Babur threw his hat into the ring. He was only 13 years old. When he reached the walls of Samarkand, he found two cousins had had the same idea, and were already putting the city to siege. Instead of fighting each other, though, the young princelings decided to pool their resources in an act of family unity, in order to fight the other member of their family who held the city. But when winter came, the cousins were forced to call off their siege. But the following spring, Babur returned, and after a 7-month siege, and at the ripe old age of 14 years old, Babur entered Samarkand in triumph. This was the city of Timur, and Babur relished the chance to admire the sights, the Islamic colleges founded by the conqueror and his successors, the city walls, all 10,000 yards of them, the famous observatory of Ulugh Beg, the tomb of Timur himself, the vast markets where traders from China, from India, from Europe, and everywhere in between bartered over goods from across the known world, and of course the 9 gardens with their exquisitely decorated pavilions, courtesy of the artisans brought back as slaves from Timur's conquests. Babur recorded his thoughts, quote, Few towns in the whole habitable world are so pleasant as Samarkand. End quote. So, you might be thinking, this is the start of the great Mughal Empire. Babur holds his ancestors' capital, he has claimed his birthright, and the riches and culture of India surely await. I mean, why not? Samarkand was a capital worthy of an empire, it was wealthy, and Babur was only young. With the resources and prestige of his new city, he could surely assert his authority over his family and follow Timur's footsteps across the Hindu Kush. Babur held Samarkand for 3 months. His followers had not been impressed by the rewards on offer after a 7-month siege. Samarkand was wealthy, but after the siege and the civil war, and various rulers emptying it of prizes to keep their own followers happy, the cupboards were relatively bare. Babur soon learnt a harsh truth of Timurid politics, as even those followers he viewed as unimpeachably loyal drifted away in search of greater rewards from other Timurid princes. Worse, with Babur established in Samarkand, his younger half-brother Jahangir, himself only 12 years old, with the support of the elites of Fergana, asserted control over most of the emirate. Babur marched out of Samarkand at the head of his diminished forces in order to restore his power base, but he was too late. He lost Fergana, and in his absence, other rivals took control of Samarkand. Babur was left with just the tiny fort of Kujand in Tajikistan. He had been completely outmaneuvered by his enemies and his family, which, as a Timurid prince, was often one and the same. Babur later recalled that this was, quote, very hard on me, and he admits that, quote, I could not help crying a good deal. Because he was, again, 15 years old. Everything seems like the end of the world at that age, and few of us have conquered and lost a thriving metropolis before we're old enough to drive. These were what Babur calls his throneless times. With Kujand as a base and only 200 or 300 followers, he led a campaign of raids and skirmishes. A common strategy would be to leave Kujand in the middle of the day, ride 30 to 40 miles to their target, usually a walled village or small fort, and time their arrival for after dark. Then they would sneak to the walls with ladders, seize those walls, and then fight tooth and nail until being either driven back or the settlement acknowledged their new sovereign. Often the raiding party would be spotted before they reached the walls, and the attack would have to be called off. If they encountered a rival raiding party, it would usually end with blood. But bit by bit, Babur rebuilt his power base. Soon, his mothers and sisters joined him. Bamber Gascoigne, in his The Great Moguls, which has been invaluable for this episode, describes how the fratricidal fighting within the Timurid dynasty allowed for the free travel of the women of the household. Now 16, Babur was also introduced to his new wife, Aisha Sultan Begum. His cousin, and a Timurid princess, Babur claimed that he was just too shy to visit her more than once a fortnight. But Gascoigne suggests an alternative reason, quote, his own first love affair, unconsummated, was for a boy in the camp bazaar. He mooned about the orchards and gardens, bareheaded, barefoot, dreaming and composing couplets, but whenever he actually met his love, as when with a crowd of companions he turned to the corner of a lane and came face to face with the boy, he was covered in confusion and unable to look at him, end quote. Adorable. Whenever Babur's crush was summoned to the young emir's court, his awkwardness rose to new heights. Quote, in my joy and agitation, I could not thank him for coming. How was it possible for me to reproach him for going away? End quote. These are Babur's own words, by the way. Later in his life, as an emperor, he records his own biography, which is perhaps a unique resource for historians. When he was older, Babur didn't approve of homosexuality in his court, but as Gascoigne notes, he begins his biography promising the truth, and in this case he seems to have kept that promise. Babur remained in his throneless times for a full 2 years. The young prince and future emperor would not be satisfied with a quiet life in Kujand. Soon enough, Babur will recover enough territory from his brother, Jahangir, that the two Timurid princes will come to an agreement. Fighting together to restore Babur to Samarkand. In what must have been a novelty for Babur, they wouldn't be fighting their own family for control. Thanks for listening to this first episode of The History of the Mughals. If you want to hear more, go to patreon.com/paxbritannica and sign up as an Earl or higher, for about the price of a latte per month, to borrow a phrase from a higher power. Thanks again to my House of Lords, and to you for listening.
Let Mysteries at Midnight be your destination for detective whodunits and captivating mystery stories. You'll hear classic stories like Sherlock Holmes, Agatha Christie's Poirot, and short tales from H.G. Wells, Charles Dickens, Edgar Allan Poe, and others. I'm Christopher, and I read these classic stories in the soothing style of a bedtime story, so you can listen to them in bed when you drift off to sleep. Search for Mysteries at Midnight on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app, and follow and subscribe so you don't miss out on new episodes.
What did it take to survive an ancient siege?
Why was the cult of Dionysus behind so many slave revolts in ancient Rome?
What's the tragic history and mythology behind Japan's most haunted ancient forest?
We're Jen.
And Jenny.
From Ancient History Fangirl. Join us to explore ancient history and mythology from a fun, sometimes tipsy perspective.
Find us at ancienthistoryfangirl.com or wherever you get your podcasts.